malignant mesothelial proliferations is difficult on morphology alone, and many times we have to depend on ancillary testing such as MTAP and BAP1, but neither of these are 100% sensitive, even in combination. So Dr. Churg and a couple of his colleagues looked at c-MET, a tyrosine kinase inhibitor that is upregulated in many cancers, as a potential reliable marker for distinguishing reactive from malignant mesothelium proliferations. This is a single institution retrospective study taking place at Vancouver General Hospital using their archived material of mesothelioma. They made two tissue microarrays constructed out of 0.6 millimeter cores with a minimum of two cores per case. They had a total of 33 reactive epithelial mesothelial proliferations, 23 reactive spindle cell mesothelial proliferations, 45 epithelioid malignant mesotheliomas, and 26 sarcomatoid mesotheliomas. And then they stained these entities for c-MET using the rabbit monoclonal antibody SP44 and BAP1 using the antibody SC28383 and MTAP primary antibody using 2G4. For the c-MET, they interpret it using an H-score system with, they analyzed the epithelial proliferations using only membranous staining, and for the spindle cell proliferations, they did not separate membranous from cytoplasmic staining. And then the H-score system was based on a 12-point scale, and they classified if you have zero staining, it was negative, trace was a score of 1 to 3, moderate was a score of 4 to 6, and strong was a score from 8 to 12, and this is based on intensity and the percentage of the entity that was staining. And then BAP1 and MTAP was assessed using the normal nuclear loss or retention. And what they found for c-MET staining was that the epithelioid reactive mesothelial proliferations, 3 out of 33, that's 9%, stained for c-MET. And of those 3, all of them were only trace. And then for our spindle cell reactive mesothelial proliferations, there was 0% of them stained for c-MET. And then our epithelioid mesothelioma, there was 36 over 45, which is 80% of the cases stained for c-MET, and 53% of them had a staining of moderate to strong that was greater than 3 on the H score. And then our sarcomatoid mesothelioma, 38%, that's 10 over 26, stained for c-MET, and only 15% of these were staining with a moderate or strong intensity. And then for our epithelioid mesothelioma, BAP1 had an overall sensitivity and specificity of 50 and 100%, and MTAP had an overall sensitivity and specificity of 37 and 100 respectively. And then when c-MET score of less than or equal to 3 and a BAP1 loss were used in conjunction, the sensitivity was 76%. And when c-MET score was less than or equal to 3 and MTAP loss were used in conjunction, the sensitivity was 77%. For the sarcomatoid mesothelioma, BAP1 had a sensitivity and specificity of 21% and 100%, and MTAP had a sensitivity and specificity of 63 and 100%. And then when c-MET and BAP1 were used in conjunction, the sensitivity was 38%, and c-MET and MTAP, when they were used in conjunction, the sensitivity was 71%. And then the combination of c-MET staining greater than 3 and or BAP1 and or MTAP loss was found in 36 of 42 cases, as 86% of the epithelioid mesothelioma, and 15 of the 22 cases of sarcomatoid mesothelioma, that's 68%. And then here's an example of c-MET staining in an epithelioid mesothelioma. It has membranous and can't see it really well. They also had cytoplasmic, but you can see the cytoplasmic kind of varied throughout, and that wasn't used in their interpretation for the H score. And then this right here is a sarcomatoid mesothelioma staining for c-MET, and then this is a benign mesothelial proliferation staining for c-MET that showed no staining. And then this over here is our HER2 stain, or HER3 staining, which they also threw into the study that didn't pan out to really anything for them. And so within the literature, they point out that there are some studies on c-MET staining within mesothelioma or benign mesothelial cells, and the data so far has been contradictory. And for example, there's one report that showed that 4 of 4 samples of reactive pleura were positive for c-MET staining, but they use a polyclonal antibody. And then another study showed that 18 of 34 cases of benign reactive mesothelial cells were positive for c-MET, but again, they used a polyclonal antibody. So in this study, they used the monoclonal c-MET antibody, and they showed that c-MET staining is relatively uncommon in reactive mesothelial proliferations. None of the 23 reactive spindle cell proliferations were staining for c-MET, and only 3 of the 33 reactive epithelial proliferations showed any c-MET staining. And then remember, of these 3 cases, they all were less than the or equal to the 3 on the age score, which meant that they only showed trace staining. And so the data within this paper shows that c-MET staining can be used to support a diagnosis of epithelioid mesothelioma, and improved sensitivity can be achieved by using combination of c-MET and BAP1 or c-MET and MTAP staining. However, for our sarcomatoid mesothelioma, like in many other cases, the sensitivity of the c-MET staining is too low to make this a worthwhile test. So if anybody has any comments, and I was wondering if anybody has used c-MET as to help them out in certain cases, and if they did, how they actually used it, because it seems kind of complicated for like a general pathologist to come in and use this H-score system, unless you use it all the time.
No experience and not using it.
But you cannot use it without H-score?
Oh, he said within this paper, they said that we should probably, you know, the H-score is something to use if you're in like a high volume institution, but maybe there should, you know, kind of use it more like how we grade the HER3. And typical like breast cancer and stuff for the general pathologist to use, but the H score is more in like a high volume institution.
That's definitely a drawback, because BAP1 and MTAP can be used as positive, negative, right?
Which is very easy to interpret it. Yeah.
There's a question from Kelly Butner in the chat field. Did they do a head-to-head comparison to HEG1? HEG1.
No, the only other one that they put in here was the HER3.
Yeah, but I think the other question with the c-MET is, which antibody do you have? I just looked it up. We do have the antibody they actually propose, but if you have the polyclonal c-MET, I don't think you really can use it. And then apparently you really have to look for membranous staining. And the other thing is, it's a TMA study, and they have not looked at whole tissue sections for reactive proliferation. So I think it probably needs to be some validation.
I was just curious. I'm just curious, how common are the rabbit monoclonal antibodies?
I don't know. I just know that we have it. I don't know why we chose that one and how many other monoclonals are out there.
Monoclonal is usually mouse, no?
It usually is. But yeah, there are some other monoclonal possibilities. I don't know. Yeah.
This is Kelly again. Did they get into how this will enhance practice over what we use already, the, you know, very granular detail of why someone would bring this on?
I think they're just trying to see if it will improve the sensitivity of distinguishing the reactive versus the malignant epithelioid proliferations. I think they also were maybe hoping that it would pan out in the sarcomatoid entity, but it didn't really have such a high sensitivity.
Yeah, looking at your table lazy. I was wondering the same thing.
Go ahead, Anya.
No. I'm shutting
up. How many of these were useful in the setting of a retained BAP1 and MTAP, and how many of these cases were problematic cases to begin with? I find this to be just yet another marker that is kind of helpful maybe when you don't need it anyway, but doesn't help at all with sarcomatoid problems. And I have yet to see a good marker of malignancy that can be used in most settings.
Mm-hmm. So looking at Lacey's table in the discussion, for the epithelioid mesos, it does seem to increase the sensitivity if you add it to BAP1 and MTAP, but not for the sarcomatoid.
It was right in here. Yeah, so when you added the BAP1 to the CMET score when it was less than or equal to 3, the sensitivity was 76%. And then if you used MTAP, it was 77%. But that's when CMET score was less than or equal to 3.
All right. Any other questions to that one?
Otherwise, I was going to add, Dr. Roden, that they did do whole tissue, but it looked like it was only within the malignant, not the reactive proliferations.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much, Lacey.
Yeah, no problem. So I have to stop sharing, right?
Yes, please. Yeah. All right. Let's share that one. Okay. So you should see a PDF now, hopefully. So the next article is by Young and colleagues from Memorial Sloan Kettering, and it's entitled Lung-Only Melanoma, UV Mutational Signature Supports Origin from Occult Cutaneous Primaries and Argues Against the Concept of Primary Pulmonary Melanoma. That was published in Modern Pathology. And I got just interested in that one because, I mean, we often get these even solitary lesions in the lungs that turn out to be malignant melanoma, and there is no history of cutaneous melanoma anywhere where we can find, but we do know that cutaneous melanomas can spontaneously regress, and it's also controversial whether or not there are actually native melanocytes in the lung. However, the WHO defines a primary pulmonary melanoma as a melanocytic proliferation or nodule, which is positive for IHC or electron microscopy and exclusively involves the lung, and there are no current or previous primary cutaneous, uveal, or mucosal melanomas. And also, if there is a solitary lesion of melanoma in a central location adjacent to the major airways, that is even considered more characteristic for a primary pulmonary melanoma, given a presumed origin from intrabronchial melanocytes. So the aim of the study was to investigate clinicopathologic and genomic features of lung-only melanomas to clarify their site of origin. And they performed a retrospective review of lung-only melanomas with next-gen sequencing. They used the MSK Impact NGS, which is 468 cancer genes, and they actually applied that also to 600 lung adenocarcinomas and 550 cutaneous melanomas. So in the end, they had 10 lung-only melanomas, 4 met the strict criteria of primary pulmonary melanoma by the WHO in that they were solitary lesions. They were all males with a mean age of 64 years. And again, in 4 of these cases, there were solitary lesions, and they were actually as large as 10 centimeters, and 3 of them were central periponchial. And then 4 had multiple lesions between 2 and 3, and 2 had over 10 lesions. Microscopically, almost all of them were epithelioid predominant, 2 were spindle cell predominant, 4 had melanin pigment, and 3 of the 6 with bronchial epithelium did have involvement of the bronchial epithelium, and And if you look at that figure here, figure two, so these are the epithelioid melanomas, the spindle cell melanoma, and here is one which has bronchial epithelium, but really the melanoma seems to be in the submucosa and then involving the mucosa. Same here, there is the bronchial mucosa, which seems to be secondarily involved by the melanoma. So there is no sign of a melanoma in situ. So by IHC, they were all positive for melanocytic markers, specifically SOX10 and S100, and then a few others. However, one case was also weakly focally positive for pan-keratin, and we know that this can happen. Next-gen sequencing showed a mean of 44 non-synonymous mutations, and the mean TMB was 43 per megabase pair. And frequent mutations occurred in BRAF, NRAS, NF1, KIT, and KRAS, which is the genomic profile that is typically for UV-associated cutaneous melanomas. And that is really nicely seen here in figure three. You can see all the mutations per case. And they also found alterations in TP53 and CDKN2A, which is also commonly encountered in cutaneous melanomas. In 8 cases, they performed mutational signature. These cases had over 20 mutations, and they all had a dominant UV signature. And you can see that here in figure 4, the yellow is the UV signature, that is signature 7. And basically in all the tested cases, UV or the signature 7 is the most predominant signature. And then here in figure B, they compare lung-only melanoma, which is here on the left side, with cutaneous melanomas, which are mainly composed of signature 7, which is the UV mutation signature. And then on the right side, the lung adenocarcinomas, which don't even have any component of signature 7. So the mean follow-up was 27 months. Most of these patients were treated with anti-PD-1 and anti-CTLA-4. Most patients with 1-3 lesions had a resection, and then there were extra pulmonary metastases in 70% of the cases. 3 patients died of the disease, and when we just look at the patients with the solitary lesion, one of them had metastatic progression at extra pulmonary sites. And in none of these cases, a primary melanoma was found. But based on the UV signature found in pretty much all of these cases, they concluded that lung-only melanomas should be considered as likely metastatic, even in the absence of a known primary melanoma elsewhere. And even if they meet the strict criteria of primary pulmonary melanoma as defined by the WHO. And the other thing is, we need to be aware of the epithelioid morphology of these melanomas that can closely mimic the non-small cell lung carcinoma, and specifically if they might be focally weakly positive for pan-keratin. Any questions to that one?
Yeah, this is Colby. I have a couple of comments. You know, I recall a melanoma that we put in the fascicle that I was involved in, and that one had a junctional nevus next to it in the bronchial mucosa. And did they mention anything that looked like junctional nevus? That's number one. And number two, it seems the obvious thing to look at would be anal melanomas to see if they have the same sort of signature, because we assume that there are primary anal melanomas, and a lot of people don't have their anus in the sun for very long.
So to your first question, they did not find any of these nevi, and they looked for the GNAQ and the GNA11 mutation, which apparently are characteristic of these nevi in the lung, and they did not find any of these mutations. And in regards to anal, I don't think they looked at anal melanomas. That's a good question. Yeah.
I mean, it would be obvious that if you're going to talk about lung, you'd talk about other sites where other non-cutaneous sites where primary melanoma supposedly occurs.
Right.
Well, yeah, Tom, it seems like there's that I reviewed a paper a while ago related to just what you're saying, that there's a different signature. So there's the UV signature, and then there's the signature for, you know, gallbladder melanomas and so on. And did they mention that in here at all, Anya?
No, no. Weird. They do not talk about any of these other signatures.
Huh.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I mean, the only thing is they, I think they, well, no, they didn't look at mucosal melanomas. But yeah, that's a good point.
They don't really suggest that we should manage these things any different on the basis of this, do they?
No, no. And that was my question too. Do they even, would they treat them differently? I think it's a high stage melanoma anyway. And I don't know how you would stage primary lung melanomas. I don't know, but they seem to have them treated all with anti-PD-L1 and or anti-CTLA-4. And I think that's the treatment for cutaneous melanomas as well. All right. If there are no other questions, we'll move on to the next one, which is a study by Dal Olio from the University of Bologna in Italy. And it's entitled Comparison of Sequential Testing and Next Generation Sequencing in Advanced Lung Adenocarcinoma Patients, a Single Center Experience, published in Lung Cancer. And they wanted to compare sequential single gene testing algorithm to next gen sequencing in lung adenocarcinomas in regards to effectiveness, costs, tissue consumption, and turnaround time. They performed a retrospective study involving advanced lung adenocarcinomas. This was a pretty homogeneous Caucasian population in northern Italy, given that this was a single center study. And they performed the sequential approach between January 2014 to February 2019. And afterwards, I think they just automatically switched to next-gen sequencing, which was performed between February 2019 and January 2020. For the sequential approach, they started with EGFR. And if the patients did not have a mutation in EGFR, they followed up with KRAS. And if there was no alteration in KRAS, they then performed what they called the physician-driven testing, which was mainly driven by the availability of drugs or clinical trials. And that included ALK Next, which was available since 2012 with the crizotinib approval, and then followed by ROS1, that followed by BRAF, MET, HER2, and RET, if that was requested by the physician. The next-gen sequencing in their panel included 35 hotspot mutations, 19 amplifications, 23 rearrangements. And if we look at the price, for instance, EGFR, RT-PCR cost €380, KRAS pyro sequencing €160, and so on. The IHC was €200, and then the next-gen sequencing was €770. In regards to tissue, they needed 25 micrometers tissue for NGS and 3 micrometer tissue for each slide for IHC or FISH. The turnaround time in their hands was approximately 10 days for next-gen sequencing and 5 days for RT-PCR, 5 days for FISH, and 2 days for IHC. They included 1,758 consecutive patients, including 1,221 for the sequential algorithm and 537 for next-gen sequencing. They found that their prevalence for EGFR, ALK, and KRAS alterations were very similar between sequential and next-gen sequencing. And then if we just look at the sequential, 50% of the patients were basically finished after the first round, including EGFR and KRAS. And for patients that moved on for ALK testing, 6.3% were positive, and then the remainder moved on to ROS1, and 4.7% of those were positive, and then there were 286 patients left for any other testing. Overall, they found that ROS1 rearrangements, MET amplifications, MET mutations, and HER2 amplifications and mutations, and BRAF mutations, the prevalence was higher in the sequential testing versus next-gen sequencing. But that might be because of kind of a selection bias, because there were already quite a few dropouts before the patients even got to ROS1 rearrangement. So only less than 50% of the patients actually got to ROS1 rearrangements, and that were all the patients that did not have an EGFR or KRAS mutation. And then for the NGS, they found other mutations in 26% of the cases and concurrent mutations in 24% of the cases, which of course could not be evaluated with the sequential testing. The cost for the sequential testing was €1,375 versus only €770 for next-gen sequencing. They also needed more tissue for the sequential testing, which was kind of 33.3 micrometers versus only 25 micrometers for the NGS. And the mean turnaround time was of course also higher for the sequential testing, which was 13 days versus 10 days for next-gen sequencing. So if we take it all together, the next-gen sequencing was less expensive and potentially overall faster for lung adenocarcinoma biomarker testing. However, if we only would look for EGFR and maybe KRAS or maybe just ALCROS1, then the sequential testing would be faster. And that might be more important for critically ill patients that might only need an EGFR testing, maybe a KRAS testing, and then you already have the results. What I also found interesting, but they didn't really study it in this manuscript, but they referred to other manuscripts, that there is evidence that did not show a survival benefit when using next-gen sequencing. So any questions to that paper? I don't know how you guys do that, whether you do reflex testing or whether you leave it up to the clinician which testing they want to have. I have the feeling, I mean, we do it clinician-driven here in Rochester, and I have the feeling they would like to get everything. And the main problem, I think, for our clinician is that the next-gen sequencing testing takes quite a long time. So they like to start with the EGFR and KRAS, but do at the same time the next-gen sequencing testing.
In Florida, we also do clinician-driven testing, and they basically request either Tempus or Foundation One, so yeah. Comprehensive testing.
Yeah.
Yeah, same in Arizona. We it's all sent for KRAS testing.
Okay.
Which is local in the valley.
Yeah. Well, I guess it seems also following the NCCN guidelines, which recommend the, if feasible, the broad panel-based approach, most typically the NGS.
Yeah, it's interesting that you comment on the fact that there's no survival advantage, because the logic theoretically is that you'll find other potentially treatable mutations, right? Some more rare mutations where there's maybe a monoclonal antibody, but even though this study didn't look at it, apparently other studies have, and I was often wondered about that, so.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
How expensive is Foundation? I mean, Foundation One's very expensive, isn't it? It's more expensive than doing in-house NGS, I would think.
Well, I think part of it was that the lung panel was not very big in Rochester to do NGS. I think it's grown, but Anya, you would know better about that. I think now it's, what, 70 maybe genes, something like that. But before, it was not a very large panel.
Okay.
And these tests are reimbursable these days. So insurance companies would reimburse them. I think the last I checked, it was like $4,000 or $5,000.
So I see these results coming back from Foundation One as like a massive booklet, and most of it's useless. So.
Well, but it seems that some of the clinicians really favor that they get this long description about everything. That's at least what I heard. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, but most of it's, you know, you've still got to be targeted at what yep. disease you're looking at, and I think it offers false hope, and it's. Here in Canada, some patients pay for it themselves and send their tissue off. Yeah. Just, you know, because they think they have to, they should.
So the, what I understand is, you know, we typically do our lung cancer, cancer small panel that are the practically useful. But when the patient is young and they want to just grab anything, then they send out to Foundation or Caris even. The thing is, those companies only take the insurance, whatever they pay for, and they are basically collecting the data, I understood. So it's kind of, they don't care how much, you know, they lose in terms of testing itself, but they are just accumulating massive amount of data. That's how I understand. So that's where it carries at all the business, you know?
Well, and quite a few publications. Yep. Yeah, that's right. Okay, if there are no other questions, welcome to our last article for discussion. And I know there is no journal club right now without COVID. And so here is a...
Well, it beats PD-L1. Let's just, you know...
Does it? At least currently, huh? That's right. Okay, so here is our COVID article. That's actually by Ellen Borsak, Fiorella Calabrese, and Mary Beth Beasley from New York and Padua, Italy, entitled COVID-19 Pulmonary Pathology, a Multi-Institutional Autopsy Cohort from Italy and New York City, published in Modern Pathology. And actually, I chose this article not only because they have a nice, really nice microscopic description of their finding, but they also go into their IHC and RNA-ish results. So they evaluated a large number of autopsies from three institutions in heavily hit areas, including New York City, specifically Manhattan, Queens, and Brooklyn, and Italy, covering part of the Veneto area, which, it's my understanding, was also heavily hit. They perform a detailed evaluation of several lung compartments, including airways, alveolar walls, air spaces, and vasculature. All these patients were confirmed COVID-19 positive by nasopharyngeal RT-PCR, and they performed, in a few cases, IHC using the SARS-CoV-2 spike protein, specifically clone 189. And for RNA-ish, they use a commercially available sequence for the spike protein from ACD. They included 68 consecutive autopsies of COVID-19 patients. 70% were males. The median age was 73 years old, with a range of 30 to 96. Most of these patients, almost all of these actually, had a comorbidity, and 60% had three comorbidities and more, most commonly hypertension and diabetes. And 37% were either current smokers or former smokers. Before patients died, they had a median days of disease of 11, and 40% of these patients had been intubated. They used a median of 19 lung tissue blocks, including bronchi and trachea. And 26% of the patients had an associated or superimposed non-viral, so bacterial or fungal pneumonia, as evidenced by anti- or post-mortem cultures or stains for microorganisms. Over 90% of the lungs had an increased lung weight and patchy or diffuse consolidations. And they found quite frequently tracheobronchitis. And you can see that in this figure 2, these kind of white aphthous ulcers were found quite frequently in the trachea. Then 87% of the patients had DAD. Less frequently were later phases of DAD, but that correlated with longer duration of the disease. DAD was seen together with organizing pneumonia, interstitial fibroblasts, and quite frequent squamous metaplasia. And that was likely due to ongoing viral-induced injury of type 2 pneumocytes. And there is figure 4. Let me see. Figure 4 is this one here. And so you can see some DAD, the interstitial fibroblasts, and then many of these alveolar pneumocytes were multinucleated, had kind of syncytial course pattern, and they were quite curious about these intracytoplasmic inclusions, which I thought they thought probably are viral inclusions, but they did not stain with IHC or RNA-ish. So in the end, they said there are inclusions, but likely not of viral origin. And then in 42%, they found large vessel thrombi, and in 84%, microthrombi that were at least focal. And then in some cases with clinically rapid progression to severe respiratory failure without evidence for superinfection or ventilator-associated pneumonia, they saw neutrophils together with alveolar wall injury, necrosis, and microthrombi, a little bit similar to what we may see in capillaritis. So findings like here, where we have neutrophils almost destroying the interalveolar septae, or at least it seems like. They also had evidence of small vessel injury. They did electron microscopy where they found basal membrane reduplication, endothelial swelling with cytoplasmic vacuolization consistent with endothelial cell injury. And they also say they had some virus particles in type 2 pneumocytes, and that was seen here. I think that's one of the viral particles. So they performed IHC and RNA-ish in 23 cases and 5 negative controls. They found that IHC and RNA-ish are positive in tracheal epithelium, hyaline membranes, and atypical type 2 pneumocytes of the COVID patients. And this was mainly found when the patients died within 2 weeks of onset of disease, and it was less frequent after 2 weeks. And here are just some examples. On the left side, this is actually their IHC. They have a red stain. Here you can see it in some bronchial epithelial cells. Also for the RNA-ish. And then here is the IHC positive in the hyaline membranes. Same thing here in the RNA-ish. And then these are some atypical type 2 pneumocytes as highlighted by RNA-ish, and they found by EM viral particles. So all these findings were similar between the three hospitals, and they basically conclude that COVID-19 pneumonia is a heterogeneous disease, including tracheobronchitis, DAD, and vascular injury. Patients have frequent comorbidities, specifically hypertension and diabetes, and they conclude that the disease appears to begin in airways extending to alveolar zones. Any questions to that one? I mean, the morphologic findings are pretty similar to what we have seen. There's always the question about the EM. And we had someone from our EM core facility involved with some of the lung specimens. And first they said, oh yeah, we do see the coronavirus particles. And then they backed off and said, well, they look like some cell organelles, which you also can see in other cells. So in the end, we will never be able to find a definite virus particle. But, you know, I don't know. The IHC and RNA-ish findings are very similar for us. Does anyone else do RNA-ish or IHC for SARS-CoV-2? I know the Michigan people introduced that, but I don't know if they have it officially on board. I know Jeff couldn't join us today. So we actually looked into that. We also looked at the droplet RT-PCR, and the droplet RT-PCR was much more sensitive. And so in the end, this is what we will bring up for our FFPE tissue, not the IHC or the RNA-ish, because this it was nicely specific, but the sensitivity was really low, between 30 and 40%.
Yeah, I think the issue of microthrombi remains sort of a problem. You know, there's a couple of papers that say that there's more microthrombi in COVID than there is in, say, H1N1. And you know, the paper from last month suggested they were similar, but then Lita Hariri, I'm not sure if that's come out yet, had done a big meta-analysis. And the SARS cases from 6 or 8 years ago or 10 years ago, and these SARS cases appear to have about twice as many microthrombi as, say, influenza, H1N1 influenza. So, yeah, I mean, yes, it's DAD, but, you know, I don't know whether I could, I don't know whether I'd feel comfortable saying, well, there's more microthrombi, therefore this is COVID. I still think it's kind of up in the air.
Oh, yeah, that would be difficult, I think, because then you would have to count them. And I don't even want to suggest that.
Yeah, nobody wants to do that.
Anyone seeing biopsies from people with progressive fibrosis in these patients?
I've seen a couple. Yeah? They just look like fibrosis.
I've seen a couple of lung transplant. Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of the lung, the explants, and you know, it looks like progressive DAD. You know, you get big spaces and fibrosis in the walls. There, in a couple of them, we had this peculiar sort of necrosis, and it didn't sort of look like infarct. So I don't know what that was due to. It was only in two cases, so I don't know.
For the localization of the virus, did they specify which cells harbor the virus, like epithelial cells, endothelial cells, or?
So when they looked for IHC and RNAH, they found it in the bronchial epithelial cells, the hyaline membranes, and the type 2 pneumocytes, and they did not find it in endothelial cells. Yes, that was interesting. So there are various articles out there. A few describe finding in endothelial cells, but most of the articles say they did not find any specific staining in the endothelial cells.
Because that ACE2 receptor is supposedly be present in the endothelial cells as well as in the ciliated cells. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. And that was the argument why some people specifically looked for that. And it was quite revealing that they are mostly negative. Yeah, good point. Okay. I just wanted to mention there were actually a few nice non-neoplastic articles there too. One was... let me just find it here, on the chronic hypersensitivity pneumonitis, where they performed the RNA sequencing and compared that with UIP. Probably not surprising, there were quite a few upregulated and downregulated genes in both of them, very similar, but there were also some genes that were really specific to chronic hypersensitivity pneumonitis, including some upregulated and some downregulated genes. And the other one, and I think there's probably more coming on that, is on lung cryobiopsy and a genomic classifier in multidisciplinary diagnosis of diffuse interstitial lung disease. And what they said is that basically using a genomic classifier significantly impacted the diagnostic confidence of clinicians because there was a high level of agreement between a positive genomic classifier for UIP and the final multidisciplinary diagnosis. When patients had a high-resolution CT interpreted as probable UIP, so they actually go so far as to suggest that the genomic classifier alone without a biopsy might be used in that setting. In contrast, the cryobiopsy is most useful in non-UIP pattern on HRCT.
Just a quick question. How many folks, I occasionally will get a consult where someone has done the classifier, but are any of your practices sort of routinely using it? It doesn't seem like it's being widely used, but maybe that's just a local thing.
I have not heard here. Jen, did you hear that our clinicians use that?
No, I don't. I haven't.
They're using it at Good Samaritan here in Phoenix.
Are they? Okay.
Banner University, yeah. But I can give you a little insight into that. I'm involved right now with the company that developed that genomic classifier, and we're doing multidisciplinary review of cases so that they can be published. And I would say that, and these are just all-comer ILDs, and I would say that only in about 25% does it look like the genomic classifier would be a critical thing. Sometimes the clinician who's involved, who's Lisa Lancaster, will say, well, I don't really need that now. I need other information now. So it's not the be all to end all. I think there's a niche where it'll be useful, but how big that niche is yet to be defined.
Yeah, well, thanks, Tom. That's helpful.
Well, more to come, I guess. All right. Well, thank you very much. I wish you all happy holidays and all the best for New Year. I hope that will be less exciting, at least in regards to COVID.
Thank you, Anya.
Thanks a lot, Anya.
Thank you, Anya. Thanks, everybody.
Fantastic. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Lacey.
Thanks, Anya. Thanks, Lacey.
As well.